Hello again and welcome back. We're going to be talking about bitcoins in just a moment, but first here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio on the Beacon Newsroom is following today. Missouri Secretary of State Jason Kander has unveiled what he calls the most comprehensive ethics package in recent history. The proposal would reinstate campaign contribution limits, ban lobbyist gifts to elected officials and their staff, and make it a crime to obstruct an investigation by the Missouri Ethics Commission. A Missouri state senator is formally calling on the state education commissioner to resign. Democratic Senator Marie Chappelle Nadal of University City filed a formal resolution today asking Chris Nicastro to immediately leave office. Chappelle Nadal says Nicastro has been less than truthful, a quote there, in dealing with the legislature. Meanwhile, the Missouri State Board of Education, which already has embraced new Common Core standards for public schools, will hear later today from opponents of the standards. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. A few weeks ago, we told you about two local businesses that participated in a transaction using the digital currency Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a concept that seems to be catching on, and baby steps, perhaps. It is admittedly quirky, has a global reach, and is complex. It has also fostered Bitcoin currency speculation, resulting in dramatic ups and downs in Bitcoin value. That transaction I mentioned, a $3,000 deal, was between a company called Articulate Ventures and a client, Paradigm New Media. We thought we'd get an update on that transaction and any other Bitcoin activity in our area. Joining me in studio is Vance Crowe of Articulate Ventures and Rob Long, a miner of Bitcoins. Thanks very much for being with us. Vance, good to see you again.
Good to see you again, too.
Okay, bring us up to speed. It was December 4th, I think, when we spoke. You had that $3,000 deal. How has it gone since? Is it still to your satisfaction?
You know, it's been an exciting ride because since that time, watching Bitcoin come into my account, and then I just held on to it for a while and watched the news. And upon the news of Overstock.com saying that they would accept Bitcoin as a form of payment, just last night, I was able to sit at my computer and use Bitcoins to purchase a dry erase board. So if you look at the whole cycle, I was paid in Bitcoin, and then I used that money to buy a physical object.
I'm curious as to the value of the Bitcoin that you received in the transaction with Paradigm and the value of the Bitcoin used in your most recent transaction. Was it the same?
No, you know, I think I operated a little bit at a loss, maybe about $20 or $30 from when I received the payment until what I used. But more than anything, that amount of money was worth it to me and my company because I was able to learn about how can you use Bitcoin, how can you apply it to making everyday transactions.
Are you encouraged on the basis of this limited experience that you've had to continue trying to use it?
Well, you know, as I was listening to the radio this morning, I heard Terry Gross doing her intro, and she said that one-third of all Americans have had their security breached with the credit card thing that happened with Target. And when I was buying with Bitcoin yesterday, I didn't have to enter any credit card information at all. All I had to do was send Bitcoin to their public address, and they are going to ship me a dry erase board to my house. There's no vulnerability in that transaction to have my data breached in the same way that it could with a credit card.
And yet we've talked about this before. So much of the work that you've done has been online, and we've also heard many stories about problems with security online.
You know, online security is something that is so difficult because we're going on in our regular everyday lives and we now have this added thing that we have to be mindful of. How much information can you put on there? What can people do? And when you start talking to people that really understand computers and security, it can seem a little bit like magic.
So
go ahead.
Oh, pardon me. I just want to chime in here with that. That part of the security aspect of this is that the transaction is not reversible. So if you buy something with a credit card, there's up to 90 days later, you can call up the credit card company and say, stop that payment. And there's no recourse in that case. So they need to have your address, your contact number. They need a really good indication that you are who you say you are. But with Bitcoins, it's not reversible. So once you transfer that, they've gotten paid for the service they provided you. So you don't need to collect all this extraneous information. So it kind of eliminates the need to hold all of that stuff on a server somewhere where it could be vulnerable and rely on, you know, Target's IT guy to set that up correctly.
But couldn't the Bitcoin that are out there somewhere, I mean, you've got them in a wallet or some such, we're all getting used to the terms, and needless to say, a lot of people are just kind of feeling their way with this. Couldn't the Bitcoin, Rob, I'll turn back to you,
yeah,
be diverted? to someone else's wallet?
No, it really can't. It works in the same sort of mathematical structure that public-private key cryptography is, and that's kind of that's the basis for all secure connections on the internet. So there's basically two halves of a key, and you are the only person that controls both of them. You give your public one to everybody else, and only your private one can actually unlock it. And it's mathematically secure. So in that sense, it means you would have to try random possibilities to come up with the key until the end of the universe. You could never do it. It's just there's too many possibilities there. So that difficulty in solving this mathematical problem is what protects your ability to control your account.
Another question for you, Rob Long, and what is a Bitcoin miner?
Okay, so
someone over under 21?
Yeah. Well, not necessarily, not so much anymore. But yeah. Basically, it's you have a machine that is attached to the internet, and what you are doing is every 10 minutes there's what's called a block, and each block is a series of transactions that have happened in the Bitcoin network. So all of these people who are mining are actually providing the utility of the whole network. And the reason that they do that is because there's an incentive of getting 25 bitcoins for each block that is correctly mined. And that's why everyone is out there trying to do this.
You're beginning to lose me here. What are you actually mining, the bitcoins themselves?
Well, actually what you're doing is doing a mathematical computation. And you're just changing a little value every time and looking for – it's an arbitrary definition of difficulty, okay? So you're generating a string of numbers which looks random, and in a sense it is, but you're trying to have a certain number of leading zeros at the beginning of that, and you can't predict based on the input how many there will be there, so you just have to iteratively try, and everybody throughout the whole world is doing this right now.
To what end?
In order to hash this latest block. So that's basically signing it cryptographically to all the other previous transactions that have happened. So it ties it mathematically with that same way that I was talking about that secures your account, that connects it to all the previous history of the network so that you can look from the very beginning of Bitcoin, the Genesis block, the very first one, and trace every single Bitcoin through every transaction that's ever happened, and that's all publicly available.
Who are you doing this for, yourself or clients or?
Personally, I'm doing it for myself, but as part of I'd like to help other people in St. Louis understand how this works.
Could you be called a speculator? Are you speculating on the value of the Bitcoin?
No, I wouldn't call myself a speculator. I haven't, dumped any money into this. I'm mining. I have a few Bitcoins. But my view on this is that it is a valuable technology for the future, right? So that, in 1991, if somebody came to you and said there's this new thing called the World Wide Web, it's really going to be cool. There's going to be business will happen there. Everything will move to this. You could call that person who would say, I'm going to put some money into that, a speculator, and they are in a sense. But it's not just like I'm going to buy oil futures or something like that. There's a utility to society behind this that I think is a really important thing.
But I have to think back. At one time, there was something called MySpace, too. And it's now long gone. I mean, that would seem to me would be a concern that you might have, Vance.
That's a really good way of thinking about it in that when, say, they came up with the idea of social networking, there were many ideas on ways that could play out. It could play out as MySpace or Facebook or any of the other number of things. So it's important to remember when you're thinking about Bitcoin that Bitcoin may not be the thing that moves forward, but the concept is what's so important here. It's that currency in its current form really has some major limitations and hasn't kept up with the global economy, the changes that have happened. So some form of what they call cryptographic currencies will come about. The digital currency is one thing that I think Rob and I would both agree. It solves some problems with regular buying and selling that paper money never will.
It seems to me, again, looking at this at the very early stages, that this is a little bit too complex for most people. My understanding is that it is really attractive to people up to about the age of 40, the generation that grew up using the technology that's all over the place now, but that it is very complex to try to figure it out. I've had done two programs on this, and I'm still wondering how it works.
Well, I think that actually shows the opportunity here, and that's the reason that I keep talking about Bitcoin, both with my clients and with you, Don, is that because it's so complicated, that's because it's still in its raw form. Bitcoin, it doesn't have all of the smoothed over edges. If you'll remember when the internet was coming of age, at first it was really difficult for people to use and only computer programmers could. But it also provides opportunities for people that can come up with ways to simplify it and make it easier for people like you and me. Then they can make money off of solving people's problems about how do I use Bitcoin, which is why I want to talk. I think St. Louis should look at this as an opportunity. There are computer programmers here that could be finding ways to make Bitcoin simpler for people like you and me.
How many businesses do you think or do you know in St. Louis that are using Bitcoin now?
Well, there is a fascinating map that you can get if you go online and you go to I think it's called coinmap.org, and it shows all of the people that they can find all over the world that have agreed to accept Bitcoin. So, for example, in St. Louis, there's about 10 companies, including one called Hydraulic Pictures. So they will help you make videos about your company, and they have said publicly, we are willing to accept Bitcoin in exchange for doing that. So at least 10 right now, and really that's another place for opportunity, because if you put your name out there, you're one of just a few places that will do it. And if people are like me and they have Bitcoins and they want to find ways to spend it, I'm much more likely to go to places that are willing to spend accept my Bitcoin payment.
Rob Long, will you buy my it's too complex for most of us theory, and do you see any ways to make it less so?
Yeah, absolutely. It is too complex right now. It's like if you had to know the IP address of Google when you wanted to search for something, you'd never find anything. It's it's all been simplified so that you just type in the name of the thing you want, right? And I think that those sorts of intermediate services, like Vance mentioned, that local people hopefully will come up with ways to supply to the market, will kind of ease the adoption of this. And as things become easier and easier, people will see different specific domains where they can be used. So payment processing online for buying things is the obvious first target. But then you get into the area of, you know, places where you have kind of unstructured, where people come together and meet, like farmers markets and places like this, where you don't necessarily have access to a data connection. And even, you know, if you wanted to use something like Square, which is an amazing piece of technology from St. Louis native people, mm-hmm. that maybe you don't have cell reception there, and you could take a picture of somebody's QR code that represents their address, and then when you go back into cell coverage, then process your transaction then. There's a lot of things that you can imagine of ways that this could be innovated on.
We have a little time left for phone calls. We'll try to get some folks into the conversation. 382-8255 is our number. You can also send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on air. Vance, can you walk me through something here? Let's just say I want to acquire some Bitcoin because I want to get in on this. I want to do business with you. Walk me through it.
So the way that I did it and the way that I've helped other people that I know do it is I go to a place called Coinbase, and it's just coinbase.com. And it is a company that's been funded to make this process easy. So it's just like going to a website. And what you do is you put in your account numbers from a check, the same way that if you had written out a check, you know, there's the routing number and the account number on there. You enter that information on
there. Where do I get those numbers?
Well, I mean, you have to use a bank account, right? Because we have to transfer
my actual bank account, those numbers.
Right. Okay, and that's the thing that makes people feel a little bit nervous. And I think, you know, rightly so. You are going to a website and entering your account number and your routing number, but it's the easy way to do it so that you're not trying to, you know, I kind of think of the exchanges for Bitcoin as a little bit of the Wild West, and mm-hmm. Coinbase is one of those places that you can go and purchase Bitcoin. So if you want to take $900 out of your bank account, and then someone will send you a Bitcoin and it will hold that wallet that we were talking about for you.
They will send me a Bitcoin, but it will be a virtual coin.
It will remain digital, as Bitcoins are always just a digital. The value is stored between those two numbers that Rob was talking about, the public number, which is the indoor, and the private number, which allows you to send money out.
And Rob, my concern is that $900 that I've taken out will suddenly be worth $450, although it might be worth $1,800 mm-hmm. The following day.
Well, I would say that if you can't afford to lose all of that $900, don't mess with it.
Me here.
There's no need to speculate. That's exactly right. I think if you're interested in it and you can, you know, afford to lose it, go ahead and put it in there. I'm not saying I think it's going to go down or up or either way. I just think that it's an early adoption phase. It's an experimental technology, and that's why I'm involved with it right now.
Why is it having these wild fluctuations? Last, I think it was up valued at $1,200 at one time. Since you had your transaction, Vance, it went down considerably and then went back up again, right? How wild a swing was it during your time?
You know, I think I watched it climb a couple hundred dollars and then drop all the way down to 450 or 550. But those fluctuations, one of the things about Bitcoin that I think is important to remember is the price is a little bit like looking only at your speedometer when you're driving your car down the road. If you only stare at your speedometer and worry about how fast or slow you're going, you're not watching the scenery go on around you. And the scenery is actually what makes Bitcoin so valuable. This technology is vastly more capable than the things we're talking about is just storing value.
Yeah. We have a call I'd like to bring in here. As time will allow, we'll take calls. Aaron in St. Louis, go ahead. You're on the air.
My question is, if your account is hacked, because hacking seems to be the crime of the future, who is the cop on the beat? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Say hacking is the crime of the present also.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think this would be just like any other, you know, there's the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. There's a whole bunch of federal laws and I'm sure state and local laws that involve inappropriate access of computer networks, impersonation. There's any number of existing laws that would cover theft of something like this.
Yeah. Well, law will certainly have to be written to accommodate this as it grows, needless to say.
Right. And that's exactly the reason that we hope that legislators, people like Mayor Slay of St. Louis or the county executive, all of these people should be trying to bring together as many people that understand the Bitcoin system so that way we can write laws that protect people and also encourage its use and adoption so that way we can do it in a way that makes it so I can pay my taxes the correct way and I can make sure that I'm paying people in a way that's safe.
Could Bitcoin be subject to inflation?
In a sense, yes. I mean, in anything, if it's the ratio of the currency to the things that it is purchasing and the demand for that currency determines its relative purchasing power. But the amount of Bitcoins in existence cannot be changed. That is something that is fixed in the algorithm.
It's a finite number of Bitcoin
yes.
out there.
Whereas if you think about what's going on with the U.S. dollar right now, just in the span of this conversation, 10 minutes, there have been many millions of dollars, you know, quote unquote, printed. With Bitcoin, there's only 21 million. So that same problem that you have with the Federal Reserve printing money, you don't really have in Bitcoin.
Why was it set to 21 million, or why was it set as a finite number at all?
This was the creator of it, who is the Satoshi Nakamoto. Is his pseudonym, and we say that because we don't know who that individual is. But he wrote that into the algorithm the way he created it initially. And I can't really speak about his reasoning on the exact number there, but each one is subdividable into 100 millionths. So, we're not going to run out of the ability to exchange them, even if everyone in the planet wants to have some.
See, that's another red flag for me. If the guy who got this whole thing started is using a pseudonym, why do I want to jump in with both feet with my $900?
Well, it's a politically charged thing, a currency. It has a lot of properties to it that render it – that you can transfer value around instantaneously between individuals. And you could imagine that people would want to abuse that power. And I think he just wanted to avoid any of the spotlight on that to say, just judge it based on the algorithm and not on my personality and my background.
Which actually brings up something kind of interesting. Bitcoin is built with open source. So you or I or any computer programmer can go and look at the code that makes it up. It's not some black box that we can't go and look at. And by virtue of it being open source, we can have millions of people make sure that we all agree that it's code that is good, it's right, and it's functional.
Another aspect of this that occurs to me would have an impact. If we have a finite number of Bitcoin established at 21 million, and you believe in the theory of supply and demand, as demand goes up, the value of the Bitcoin is going to go up, and there again sends us on this crazy potentially roller coaster ride for value and making it difficult, Vance, for people like you to make these transactions knowing that, you're not going to lose a ton of money or maybe gain a ton of money at the end.
I think that this is really a good time for people to start looking at basic economics. I mean, you're right. As the demand goes up, we would hope that the price would go up. We would assume through economic theory. But the other side of it is you can buy – you don't have to buy one full Bitcoin at $900 right now, or if it's $1,000 tomorrow. You can buy just one very small part of that. So whatever money you would like to put into the Bitcoin system, you can do. You can have it just be – $50 or $5, whatever works for you.
As so, Rob says, whatever you're prepared to lose.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. But and also, I'd like to say too that, you know, the stability of Bitcoin in relation to the U.S. dollar, that price per dollar of Bitcoin, is certainly unstable right now. But I think if you look at the long run of it, the stability is actually greater than U.S. currency in this case. And I think that that's something that I'm interested in the long run, is a place where you can store value where government policy cannot induce you to consume it. Like right now, that's the Fed economic policy is consumption, low interest rates, borrow, spend.
30 seconds left. Okay, if you make a lot of money on your Bitcoin, how is it taxed?
You know, my understanding is that it's a capital gains, but I was actually talking to my attorney earlier this morning, and he said, you know, it's good to talk to an accountant, and I would be happy to talk with an accountant that's willing to learn the technology to give me the best available advice that they can. So,
you know, I'd have to think there probably aren't a whole lot of accountants out there at this stage of the game anyway.
I would recommend there's a whole lot of business out there for accountants that are willing to learn.
Potentially that is the case. Thank you so much, Vance Crowe, for being with us once again.
This has been great.
It's a fascinating subject, and we'll watch it closely because obviously something's going on out there that a lot of people are paying attention to. Rob Long, thank you for being with us.
Thanks.
Good luck with your continued mining, whatever that is. Thanks again for being with us. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporter Nicholas Pistor about his new book, which examines a crime in the 1870s, which happened in Saxtown, a hamlet near Millstadt, Illinois. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.